Today's talk is given by Dr. Stuart Barr of Newcastle University. His talk is entitled Urban Heat Risk Assessment and Adaption Using Spatial Modelling and Earth Observation. Dr. Barr is a senior lecturer in Geographical Information Science in the School of Civil Engineering and Geosciences at Newcastle University. His research focuses on the use of geospatial engineering within earth systems engineering applications, with an emphasis on the use of spatial analytical approaches for the analysis of cities, spatial risk assessment of climate change hazards within those cities, and the spatial analysis and modelling of complex coupled spatial infrastructure networks. So working on a range of cross-disciplinary problems sees much collaboration with civil engineers, developing robust solutions and adaption options for a range of climate change hazards. Dr. Barr is a member of the University Centre for Earth Systems Engineering and also the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. And given some of our recent weather events, we therefore look forward to a very informative and relevant seminar. Stuart.
Thank you. I realise I've worked so much, that's actually quite frightening. And what I'd like to do over the next 45, 50 minutes is show you some of the work that we've been doing at Newcastle in the Centre for Earth Systems Engineering, which is leveraging and using intensely some of the sort of spatial analysis, GIS and remote sensing techniques that myself and several people have been working on over a number of years at Newcastle. So first of all, I need to recognise that the work I'm going to present today is not just that of my own or even that of my sort of group that I nominally manage and have a set of RAs and PhD students in, but it's also a collective effort with in particular, Jim Hall, who is director of the Environmental Change Institute at Oxford University, who was insane enough to get me involved in this work on cities and adaption to climate change in the first place. And so I have Jim to thank for all the work I've done, more or less, over the last 10 years in this arena. And also Richard Dawson, who's our current director of the Centre for Earth Systems Engineering, and who, again, we've worked with very closely within geospatial engineering in producing this work. As I go through, I'll mention names of people who've contributed particular pieces of work to the presentation, just to duly recognise their input. So, where are we starting from? Well, just about any presentation that's about cities these days, or urban areas, tends to come up with this sort of ubiquitous initial statement that says we know now that actually in excess of 50% of the global population are living in urban areas, and most of that is concentrated within very large urban areas in excess of 1 million inhabitants, and that most people, urban dwellers, like our many other people here today, are actually responsible for a disproportionate amount of the global emissions that we're seeing that are driving climate change. So most projections say that approximately 80% of the global greenhouse gas emissions are actually coming from people, from activities within large urban conurbation cities around the globe. The implication of that is that not only are cities providing a disproportionate input to climate forcing, but also, in all likelihood, they're going to be disproportionately affected by the resulting change in climate. And there's a lot of good evidence now that we're going to see cities as being major contributions or major concentrations of chronic stress extremes within the resulting flooding, water scarcity, such as droughts, heat and temperature changes that we're going to see, and also related aspects of air quality, health and biodiversity changes. And that's more or less, we can see that it's going to be intensely focused on the existing urban areas that we have. So clearly there's a drive or a need to start to consider how do we adapt to these hazards. And about 10 years ago, when I first started getting into this sort of field, there's a lot of talk about mitigation and adaption. But now really, the name of the game has actually moved almost purely within certainly engineering, looking at adaption. The mitigation game has started. I think there's a general realisation that the amount of changes we can make to people's behaviour over the required time period is going to be relatively small in terms of climate change. And so most of the work now that you see within engineering and engineering cities is around how do we adapt and change the future configuration of our cities and urban areas to be more resilient, robust to the climate changes that we may see taking place. Now in the UK, most of this work from a, as I said, an engineering perspective started about 10 years or so ago when the EPSRC developed its ARCC programme and related series of projects or grants. And so ARCC stands for Adaptation Resilience to Climate Change. It's a long-term continuous rolling programme in the EPSRC portfolio, which is essentially focusing on how do we adapt, how do we develop new strategies, new knowledge about how not only cities, but infrastructure systems, transport systems, water sectors can change their behaviour and adapt as a result of the likely climate changes that we're going to see. And within the ARCC programme, there's been about 8 projects over a 10-year period that have been funded just to look really at cities. There's a bit of ambiguity there because some of them are also looking at infrastructure, and you can't look at cities without considering water supply and also wastewater removal as well. And the idea behind those projects is essentially to give us a new evidence base about how we can make informed decisions about how to best adapt cities into the future and the climate change. Now, the work that we've done under ARCC at Newcastle University and also Oxford University, we've been working for about 2006 on developing what we call an urban integrated assessment framework. This is essentially our analytical toolbox, which is a suite of analysis modules, prediction models that people have developed, and impact assessment modules for actually assessing spatially and into the future the likely impact certain climate-forced changes are likely to have on cities. So looking at the effect of future flooding predictions, future heat, so on and so forth. And the work that originally started under the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, they were initially our first funders of this back in 2006, and then subsequently we've been funded through EPSRC on 3 ARCC-related projects. And certainly in the EPSRC world, it's all about your acronym. So we have ARCADIA, which stands for the Adaptation and Resilience of Cities, SCORCIO, which is looking purely at the heat of cities, and SWERVE, which is looking at severe weather on cities, heat being a component of that. And all I'm really going to do today, actually, is focus primarily on the heat work that we've been doing. We're looking at how sensitive cities, and in particular London, is likely to be in the future to future heat increases and temperature rises. Having said that, I think it's worth just giving an overview of what the Urban Integrated Assessment Facility actually looks like. The idea behind this sort of toolbox that we've been developing, the suite of software, is that we can reduce this sort of scaremongering, which is actually a still from probably the second most diabolical film about severe weather and climate change called Flood. I don't know if anybody's seen it or even read the book. Basically, there's a catastrophic tidal surge that comes up the River Thames. Every single major river in the Thames Valley starts flooding simultaneously. The Lee Valley has a catastrophic flood going down it as well. And essentially, the whole of London becomes completely buried under about 15 feet of water. And the sort of thing that gets lots of headlines, makes a really nice movie, you can do some clever CGI with it, but in fact, it's very far from the reality of the situation. Second only to the day after tomorrow, where I have to genuinely recognise that if you can have a new glacial period within 48 hours, and it does really completely usurp London getting flooded within a 24-hour time period. The idea behind the Urban Integrated Assessment is actually to try and move away from this type of scaremongering, Armageddon type of situation in terms of prediction, or projection more accurately, and start to provide the tools where we can start to understand spatially on the basis of well-founded models from engineering, from different sectors such as water and hydrology, from the climate change scientists and from the urban modellers, how different impacts may affect a city in the future. So here, for example, this is actually a case where we've looked at flooding, where we've looked at the 100-year inundation floodplain. We've looked or simulated what new urban development would look like as a result of some population modelling we've been doing, and then actually done a calculation of the economic cost that will result from that. So we're trying to provide these new informed tools for planners and decision makers to actually utilise. Over here we have a schematic of actually what the Urban Integrated Assessment Facility or framework actually looks like at the current time. We have worked quite a lot with economic modellers, in particular from Cambridge Econometrics and Cambridge University, and one of the major inputs into our part of this framework is actually long-term economic projections, which are coming out of a model called MDA, essentially so European-wide economic and employment prediction model. We've also done a lot of work with the climate change scientists, so we've done work paired closely with Hadley Centre at the Met Office, and also colleagues in Newcastle for generating our weather generator extreme weather sets, essentially future predictions of pluvial flooding, tidal flooding, heat waves, and droughts that we expect to take place. And then within this, the work that we've kind of focused on within Newcastle and Oxford is we've developed a set of spatial models primarily based around predicting future population, and then from that future development within a city, parameterised by a whole host of different spatial data sets and databases, and then used that within an impact assessment module to understand the impact that our extreme events may have on the future population and development patterns of the city. So quite a complex sort of interaction and exchange between a range of different models from a range of traditionally different sectors within engineering. Okay, so the bold kind of rectangle boxes represent different types of models that are all feeding into each other within this approach. So that's an overview, very brief, very quick overview of the Urban Impact Assessment Framework. And what I want to do today is just focus on how we've used this to actually start to look at the heat and future heat rises that may take place and the sorts of impacts that they may have on a number of cities, but in particular London. And one of the things about doing cities-related research in the UK is you just don't get funded unless you work in London. But bizarrely, London is an outlier compared to the rest of the UK in terms of its size, in terms of its economics, in terms of just about every single property you could describe a city by. But it's the name of the game as far as the funding agencies are concerned in terms of getting your work actually funded. So we're interested in looking at the future temperature rises and understanding how they're going to affect London in particular. And we've seen again in the literature over the last sort of 10 years or so, and certainly since the 2003 heatwave across Europe, all sorts of figures coming out, in particular about the number of extra deaths that we saw within different European countries as a result of the 2003 heatwave. Pretty strong evidence that those extra deaths were directly correlated and they were a result of the increased temperatures that we experienced in 2003. And in the United States, actually some more, rather more advanced work, well, there's actually been some work done on actually calculating the true economic cost of heat waves compared to other extreme events in terms of health provision. And what we see is that in all of these sorts of pieces of work, other than actually the sort of air quality side of things, heat waves are really a big player in terms of the cost both financially and human-wise, in terms of the effect that it can have on a population compared to other forces. Of course, heat is spatially variable, obviously, and so the impact of a particular given heat may be different at different locations or different places. And actually, we even recognise this within the UK, within England and Wales, where we have these different threshold temperatures for what we consider to be an extreme heat event. So, for example, in London, we don't actually have an official health or an official heatwave trigger warning for population health until it is predicted that we're going to have a 32 daytime temperature degrees C, followed by 18 degrees C in the evening, followed by the next day being 32 as well. If that's what the forecast is predicting, that triggers the London Health heatwave warning action. In the northeast, where I'm from, at the moment, much lower temperatures. 28, 15, 28 is actually the trigger for the consideration of there being a heatwave warning. But essentially, population, health of the population will be at risk. Interestingly, in terms of the UK, all of these areas are regional apart from London. London's the only one which is actually a major city that actually has its own set of heatwave warning values. It's 32, 18, 32. And of course, even within London, given the huge spatial extent of it, there's going to be variability within the temperatures, temperature dynamics that we see. So we may have areas within certain parts of London which are much higher than 32, 18, 32, or maybe actually lower than 32, 18, 32. In fact, they take this temperature from the UK, from the Met Office weather station in the centre of London. Okay, that's a single point where they actually do this measurement from. Because of that, there's an interest in understanding the intra-urban variability in terms of temperature, and temperature risk to population, for most major cities in the UK, and certainly for London, that the climate change group within the great GLA, the Greater London Authority, are very interested and want to actually understand where, spatially, there is going to be heat risk into the future within the boundary of the Greater London Authority. And so, again, a ubiquitous type of overhead that we're used to seeing, this idea that you get this so-called urban heat island effect, that where we've got a larger number of buildings, a greater proportion of impervious surface material, we get a higher temperature compared to areas where we've got a greater interdispersing of vegetation, trees, grass, and water bodies, for example. But in many cases, this sort of urban heat island concept is just represented very much within this sort of schematic format. Actually measuring it and recording it across a city for the entire space extent of the city is incredibly difficult to do. And until recently, there really hasn't been full, spatially complete, long-term temperature dynamics or urban heat island maps covering most of the cities of the UK. It's just been these sort of idealised conceptual representations. In some cases, some Transnet work, particularly a lot of work, very good work has been done by the University of Birmingham, but very little work on spatially complete urban heat island representations. So, we want to look at the heat risk of a city, and in the work that we've been doing, we use a very simple approach to risk. And there are new paradigms beginning to emerge about what actually categorises or quantifies risk spatially. But in the case of the work that we've been doing and traditionally in terms of risk analysis, risk is essentially the integration of the hazard that you're actually interested in evaluating. So in our case, that's the temperature or the heat. But related to that, the underlying vulnerability of the population that that hazard, that extreme event, is actually being placed on, or the essentially the population that's experiencing the hazard, and integrated into that, the actual physical exposure of that population with respect to the particular hazard. So in fact, if you want to do a proper risk analysis, you not only need to take into account your hazard, but you need to take into account the vulnerability of the population in relation to that hazard and the exposure of the population. So we have a so-called Crichton's triangle approach to risk analysis that hopefully gives us a probability of the risk of our vulnerable population to the hazard for a particular degree of exposure to that hazard. To actually implement this, what we've been doing in our work is using a whole host of different data sets, spatial data sets for London, where we're using essentially long-term climate projections in order to give us our hazard fields, our fields, spatially continuous fields of temperature, both for the current day and into the future. A rich suite of data on census, current day census characteristics of the population, and also population models, projections, in order to help give us some quantifiable values about the future risk to future population. And then also using building stock databases and some of our own analysis approaches to try and work out exposure of people to particular types of housing quality within London. So essentially our sort of heat hazard is current day surface temperatures, UK Met Office weather station data, the climate change projections, the population vulnerability census data, and the population model projections that we've been running, and then finally the exposure is at the building level, and that's where we have ward level statistics on building stock, but also individual building classifications and some simulations of future residential development for London. So taking quite a wide range of disparate types of data and bringing them together into this single framework for heat risk assessment. In terms of current day data sets, we have been doing some work on using remotely sensed data to help characterise this. I actually come from a remote sensing background, so this is like going back to meeting my first girlfriend ever again and coming back to some remote sensing work. And what we've been doing is we were lucky enough that the NERC Dundee Receiving Station, we managed to convince them to give us every single cloud-free AVHRRC for the whole of the UK for the last 25 years from 2010 backwards. And then I dumped this onto a PhD student called Tom Holderness. And what Tom has done, quite remarkably, I think, is he's gone away and he's basically processed those 2,500 scenes that he had and essentially pulled out from those all of the scenes for which we have complete cloud-free cover for London over that 25-year time period, and they've done a long-term temperature and dynamics analysis for London using that AVHRR data. And so what we have is essentially this complete record for the last 25 years of the surface temperature dynamics of London from the AVHRR data. And if you compare this, this is actually an amazing resource, because if you actually wanted to characterise the temperature dynamics of London using UK Met Office weather stations, you'd have 4 points. You have the London Weather Centre, you have the St James's Park Weather Centre, which happens to be a nice green space. You then also have Heathrow, which happens to be a runway, which is now in high albedo, tends to be a lot warmer. And then you also have Northolt. Okay. There's also another host of weather stations in London, but which don't necessarily have the long-term quality of data logging and record that is actually suitable for doing this type of long-term analysis of temperature dynamics. And in fact, the Met Office themselves don't use that and don't publish it within the BABC database, British Atmospheric Database. So Tom has managed at least now to give us this 25-year record of what we're pretty convinced is basically cloud-free, we've done all the corrections, we've calculated or processed the data to add surface temperature estimates for London. And we've got in the order of, I think, I can't exactly remember, but it's in order of about 385 scenes in total over the 25-year period. And so what we are now able to do is start to understand a little bit better things like the diurnal warming and temperature dynamics of London. So here's a set of AVHR images taken on the same day during one day during the 2003 heatwave. And so what we see is this rapid blooming that takes place on the urban of the surface temperatures during the course of little more than about 3 hours during the day. And one day I will track Tom down and he will give me the legend for these plots. So I apologise about that. But you'll just have to take my word for it. The actual legends are directly comparable against each other. So where you see this intensive red coming up, this is a dramatic, real increase in temperature compared to 11:42 in the morning. So being able to work in this understanding of when, during the diurnal cycle, we might start to see increased risk to vulnerable populations at particular times during the day. So when we start to see these rapid plumes in heat occurring over the urban surface. This all comes, on the use of remote sensing however, comes with a little bit of a health warning. One of the pieces of work that Tom did, that we initially thought would be absolutely amazing, was we went away and we processed for every single year the average summer urban heat island intensity. This is a standard metric that's used to measure essentially how much hotter urban areas are than the surrounding rural lands. And so what normally you do is you take the difference between a weather station out in a rural area compared to the temperature difference within a weather station in the urban area. Okay? And a lot of the literature indicates that when you have heat waves or very hot weather, you'd expect the urban heat island intensity to be much higher in the urban, for the urban area as opposed to other background time periods. However, what Tom actually found out was exactly almost the opposite of this for the AVHR data. That when we calculate the urban heat island intensity for a relatively cool summer, so this is the average summer temperature up here, so where we've got temperatures which aren't getting much above 17, 18, 19 degrees on average, we get the largest urban heat island intensity on average across London. And yet, in the year when we've got the heat wave, 2003, very high, consistent, prolonged high temperatures across London, we get the weakest urban heat island intensity across London. And so we have to be very careful, particularly using remote sensing, that while we can get these spatially complete representations of urban temperature dynamics, we have to be very, very careful over the metric that we use to characterise them. Now this comes with a bit of a health warning in that some very similar work has been done by the University of Birmingham now using MODIS data, and they get the opposite results to us. So there's a bit of bottoming out to be done about exactly what is going on here, about whether this is just an anomaly in the data or whether there's some reason why we're getting these differences between the two sets of results. However, important to realise this has been done on the most comprehensive set of AVHR data that I know anybody's ever worked on for looking at intra-urban temperature dynamics. Okay, this is based on these sort of 365 pre-processed, cloud-free AVHR scenes.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm a huge
That's a satellite sensor called the Advanced Very High Resolution Radiometer, and it captures images. Each one of those cells you can see in that in those pictures is 1.1 kilometres in size, and in this particular case, it captures two thermal bands, and you can convert those thermal bands into estimates of that surface temperature. Okay? So that's what we're looking at here, is these estimates of surface temperature. Yeah, so it's thermal infrared. Moving on, that's some of the work that we've been doing with remote sensing that's still active and ongoing. And if you're interested in that, there was a paper published in the International Journal of Remote Sensing just over a year ago on this work about the urban peak tidal intensity that Tom did. But moving on, I'm thinking about future heat. What we've been doing in our work is using the UKCP, that's the UK Climate Change Programme, long-term projections of future temperature in order to try and understand what the temperature dynamics of the city will look like into the future. I don't want to spend too long on UKCP because it's fairly complex stuff, even the user interface is a bit of a nightmare to use. But essentially what this gives us is for certain time periods into the future, a probabilistic PDF, probability density function, of the likely temperature increases we may see for particular percentiles. So in 2060 to 2089, for this particular run of a particular suite of climate models, the 50th percentile is likely to say there's going to be a 2 degree increase in temperature. However, the 90th percentile of the distribution, we may be seeing up to 6 degrees change in temperature. Okay. So we can use these climate change projections in order to try and work out what the changes are going to be in terms of the temperatures within a city. Now, in order to do that, my colleagues at Newcastle have developed what they call a spatial weather generator. The UKCP are long-term projections which are run from a suite of GCMs which feed a suite of RCM models and then come up with these probability density functions. And each one of these probability density functions represents a 25 kilometre by 25 kilometre grid square across the whole of the UK. In order to look at intra-urban temperatures, though, we need a much finer spatial resolution or cell size. And so what the spatial weather generator does is it generates what we call a stochastic long-term time series of the future weather parameterized by the UKCP climate projections for each 5 by 5 kilometre cell within a city. And these stochastic weather generations or predictions are correlated both spatially, so your weather space, your future prediction of weather is spatially correlated. Where you get high rainfall, the cell next to it is expected to have relatively high rainfall. A cell 10 kilometres away or 20 kilometres away would be expected to have lower rainfall, so spatial autocorrelation. And also correlated temporally, that they run a long time series, and so one day if you've got a hot day in one particular point in the series, you're going to have a hot day the next day, although the heat will taper off as you go through or further away from a particular point in time. Because this is a stochastic and statistical generation of weather, you have to run it an awful lot number of times. Essentially, to get something that's statistically robust, you have to run 1,030-year perturbed weather generator runs. So you take essentially 1,000, or you sample the probability density function of the UKCP distribution 1,000 times, and you run each of those 1,000 samples for 30 years worth of simulated future weather. And so you end up with an awful lot of data. When we lattice or sample up London, essentially you've got 120 sites, so you've got in the order of about 1.3 billion weather records that you have to process in order to actually get a complete spatial map of the future temperature of London. Okay? And the problem is you have to do that for each time period. So if you're doing predictions for the 2020s, you've got 1.3 billion records. For the 2050s, 1.3 billion records. The other thing that colleagues have done, and this is work that's been done at the Met Office by a guy called Mark McCarthy, is he's modified one of the Hadley Centre RCM models to actually have an explicit urban component within it. So we can add an extra parameter, which is the proportion of impervious surface material into the RCM, which gives it an extra forcing in terms of the climate change projections that you get out, because in most RCMs there isn't an explicit treatment of urban surface material. And the other thing that Mark's done is he's actually got an anthropogenic forcing factor in this RCM model as well. So he's added in different ranges of anthropogenic heat output ranging from 25 watts per metre squared in suburban areas through to 75 watts per metre squared in the centre of London. So trying to look essentially at, if we've got increased air conditioning usage, what does that mean in terms of anthropogenic heat output into the future? And then force that into the regional climate model. The result of the weather generator, or the urban spatial weather generator, the work done by the Met Office and Chris Kilsby at Newcastle University, is that once you've processed your 1.3 billion records, aggregated them together into a complete spatial field, you end up with essentially a map that gives you some idea of the temperature that you may expect within certain areas, 5 by 5 kilometre grid cells in London, for a particular time period into the future. And you can run this or use it for a whole host of different types of configuration of the climate change models, so a low, medium and high emission scenario, which is what UKCP produce, and also then low, high and medium emission scenarios, but with the urban anthropogenic forcing that the Met Office have introduced. So we can produce this very rich set of data layers that describe in some way a projection of future temperature within the city. However, the weather generator and the urban surface temperatures from remote sensing is only part of the story. We've got the hazard now, we've got future temperature, we've got current day surface temperature, but we haven't got the vulnerability and we haven't got the exposure work to go alongside that. So what we've been doing is trying to think about how do you characterise vulnerability and exposure in terms of thinking about a city. So when we look at vulnerability, a number of studies from the 2003 heatwave, in particular for Paris, showed that there was a much, much higher impact on people who were aged between 0 and 4, very young children, in terms of extreme heat, and also to those who are aged over 75. So a bit like Carl here from up. He's a highly vulnerable person in terms of future potential extreme heat. Also, people who have long-term illness or long-term disabilities have a much higher odds ratio of being affected by extreme heat into the future than people who don't. Exposure is primarily characterised as a result of building stock, the quality of the building stock that you've got available. And again, the odds ratio was calculated that you're about 2.33 times more vulnerable or exposed if you live at the top of a high-rise building during an extreme heat event as compared to somebody who lives in a nice semi-detached four-bedroom townhouse like Russell down here. Equally, if you live in poor quality housing, terrace housing, which is old, which hasn't been retrofitted with modern insulation, then you're 1.83 times more likely to be affected by the heat, irrespective of whether you're a high or low vulnerable member of the population. Okay, so we have to bring together these odds ratios for vulnerability and exposure. To do exposure, what we've tried to do is develop an approach which can be applied to any city in the UK. So we started off with Ordnance Survey master map data, which we know corresponds to buildings. And we've tried to develop a semi-automated building stock classification piece of software. Essentially, can we take each master map building and assign to it the most likely class in terms of the type of building that it is? So clearly things like whether it's a terraced, detached, semi-detached building, but then also the likely age of construction of that particular building. To do that, we've been developing a range of approaches over a number of years, which use or combine master map, border survey master map data with address point data in order to start to give us this information about what the different types of buildings are within the city. So for example, we can actually use pretty basic topological spatial analysis to work out which buildings are detached, which are terraced, which are semi-detached. That's just basic spatial topology. Once we've got those, we then take a series of training areas or training exemplars, derive a set of spatial metrics that describe each of those training types in terms of the age of the property, and then use currently multi-logistic regression in order to try and estimate the construction age of each of the houses, whether it's detached, terraced, or semi-detached. So for each building class, if it's terraced, we'll get an indication of whether it's constructed pre-1919 or whether it's constructed post-1980s. And so the sort of results that we come out with are similar to this. So we get terraced housing, but in this case, terraced housing that was constructed pre-1919. Here we've got terraced housing, but it's by the classification, constructed 65 to 80. And then in somewhere or other, probably, we've got some areas which are post-1980s residential development. Using the address point data, we can filter out any building which actually isn't a residential dwelling within the master map data. So you can take buildings which look like other houses, but in fact might be cornered shops, for example. We can actually use the address point data to filter out the activity that's taking place. So in addition to non-residential, we can actually find out what type of non-residential activity is taking place. Is it an office? Is it an industrial complex? So on and so forth. The other thing we've been doing is thinking about how to scale this information, this knowledge about your building stock. Because when we started working with London on this, they said, oh, we want to know what's going on in every single building, or approximately what's happening in every single building. Then, when we gave them the classification, they then said, actually, we want to know what's happening at neighbourhood levels, and so on and so forth. And so we've been using some concepts from macro architecture, originally developed in the School of Architecture at Cambridge by Marcinelle Chanique, about this idea of having built form arrays, built form constellations, which starts to describe a hierarchical organisation and structure of the buildings within a city. So these are called what we commonly term built form connectivity models, that each individual building is a unit. Aggregations of the same types of building form an array, a spatial array, and then different combinations of spatial array contained within part of the transport network, the roads, the rail network, then form an urban constellation. And by using this approach, we started to develop these maps of neighbourhood or hierarchical geographies of building stock across London. So in this particular example, all of these actually comprise of multiple buildings are within them, but they actually comprise of a homogeneous block of, for example, terraced 1980s built housing, residential housing. Okay? Or in the case of this one here, terraced housing is actually represented by this brown colour. So we can sort of start to aggregate and scale up this building stock representation. All the way.
Where did you get that data from?
This data?
Yeah.
This is actually calculated on the basis of doing this analysis.
You did that yourself?
Yeah.
But how do you determine what kind of a building it is?
The building is determined by this classification approach. So we take the mass map data and we say, with address point, you can remove everything that's not residential. Okay? Once you've got the residential, we recognise whether it's semi-detached, terraced or detached housing.
How do you do that?
That's basically on whether it's topologically touching. If you've got n number of houses which are topologically touching, you have a terrace row. If you've only got two houses which are topologically touching, you say it's detached. We then take training areas and characterise them in terms of their morphology, so area, compactness, their shape characteristics of the buildings, and also in terms of what we call spatial metrics. We use, in particular, a technique called proximity graphs that build up these little graph models that say how far apart the centroids of the buildings are. And the idea behind that is that different ages of building will have a different spatial configuration and pattern in terms of compared to other areas. And then you can train your multinomial logistic regression model to recognise those. Okay, so it's a bit like supervised classification, but rather than using in remote sensing just the reflectance or the digital number of a pixel, we're using a whole suite of just morphological and spatial descriptors of the residential areas. Okay. So you take these examples, but then you're classifying the whole of London, so in the end.
So and the building date?
That's how we get the building date.
Oh, I see.
Okay, so we're saying, if you can recognise training sampling areas which are pre-1919, statistically, are they distinctive from an area post-1980 residential development?
So this is all, that's all original data you've done?
Yeah, this is all software that we've implemented in-house to do this process. So that basically takes us from, if you like, this situation where you've just got your geometry to actually having a classification. Okay. There is a caveat, it's not, like any classification, it's never 100% accurate. It gives at least a good first order estimation. And then we do the scaling up. So we then now say, okay, if we want to look at a neighbourhood or an array of these buildings which are collected together topologically, they become a built form array. If we want to understand the intermixing of arrays within a constellation, then we aggregate that up. So you get arrays, which are a collection of the same buildings, which are topologically touching each other. Okay, and then going further up, you get your constellations. And for the constellations, you get a measurement of the number of buildings of each particular type that fall within each constellation, which is defined by the road or the transport network, is the idea behind it.
Right, because then you had non-domestic buildings in there.
Yeah.
Where do you get that from?
That's from the address point data. You can take the address point data, and that tells you the basic function of every single building in the whole of the United Kingdom. So that's actually the easy part. Well, it's not actually, because for something like a university, you get one address point. So then you have to work out, actually, is this building within a certain distance likely to be part of that function? But on the whole, dealing with a non-residential is actually pretty straightforward.
And non-coniferous trees, sorry, they don't have address points.
Sorry?
I mean, non-coniferous trees?
This has been then reintroduced with a master map data in order to actually bring back some of the land use into it in this particular case. But for the work we do, we don't actually then bring in the actual vegetation. Right. Future population. So we've done exposure through the built form connectivity models and the building classification. What we do for future population is we just basically run a relatively simple population model. This is a classic, more or less a classic Lowry population equilibrium model, where essentially you take a driver about, or the drivers of it, are essentially the exogenous employment, You disaggregate that exogenous employment spatially, and on the basis of that spatially disaggregated employment, you try and assign your future exogenous population to different zones within your city of interest. So it might be, for example, at the ward level that you're trying to assign the exogenous population. So essentially, we're not predicting the total population of the city in the future. That's actually an exogenous input variable that we take from the long-term projections from national statistics, for example. But what we're essentially doing is spreading that across the city on the basis of certain drivers. So employment is one of them, but also the number of trips that take place between zones in terms of travel to work type of activity. Okay. So we have this modified Lowry population model. Within that, you can actually modify this type of population model quite easily. You can start to put in different sets of spatial attractors or constraints into it that will drive your population to different types of areas within the actual city. So, for example, we can start off with our baselines. This is some work we did not just even on London, but we went out into the Thames Gateway, where there's a lot of, well, originally, about 10 years ago, there was a big proposal that there'd be a lot of urban development out here in order to handle the excessive population growth in the southeast. And so we start off with our baseline population at the ward level, and then using the population model and different sets of attractors and constraints, we can run a series of different scenarios. So when we, in our work, our population work, we're not assuming that one single population map or output is the most likely or correct future projection for London or the city we're interested in. What we're interested in doing is running a whole host of different scenarios that look at possible futures, but some of these will never ever actually become reality. However, by doing that, we can look at the different planning options that are available to decision makers in terms of how a city can adapt to the heat hazard. So, for example, we can trend essentially the population model to move to areas where, in this case, in the eastern axis of London, essentially making it attractive to develop in areas of relatively high unemployment, high deprivation. The sort of twist to that one is the so-called suburban scenario, where essentially we start to say you can start to do some pretty horrible things to areas such as Bromley and Croydon in terms of increasing their density. We're trying to force people away from the urban centre to the urban periphery, essentially, within the population model. And also, we can run scenarios such as a centralisation one, essentially saying we're going to try and fit most of the future population of London actually in or within or around the sort of centre, the core of London's sort of central area. So all these sort of different types of scenarios that we can run through. And as I say, we're conscious, and we also emphasise this, these are just possible futures that we're investigating. They're scenarios. We're not saying one of them or another is actually the one which is actually going to take place. We just want to investigate the possibilities of adaption for these different possible scenarios. Finally, with regards to future exposure, the building stock data gives us current day exposure, but we haven't got anything about exposure of building stock into the future. So what we've done is we've developed a what we call an urban development model that essentially simulates urban development as a result of our population model. So we take the population model and the increase of population that's expected within each zone, in this case at the ward level for London, and we essentially say under a series of spatial constraints which have to be consistent with the constraints and the attractors we've used in the population model, what may be the likely areas that would be developed to accommodate that future development. So what is the likely residential development pattern going to be? And so we've developed this technique or this model called the urban development model. And in fact, it's really actually nothing more than a very kind of glorified cellular automata simulation model. So essentially, it takes a population value, it takes a parameter about the density per unit area of people that we want to try and fit into a ward, it takes spatial constraints of areas of land that you cannot develop in, it then does a suitability analysis in each ward about to find the most suitable area of land, seeds that within the cellular automata model, and then starts to simulate, grow the residential developments from there. And more or less, that's what it does. So what we end up with is this sort of pattern of residential development that accommodates the population that's predicted for each ward in London. So, result of UDM, in this case along the Thames in the southeast of London, and here we're basically seeing these dark brown areas are essentially the simulated future development patterns within each of these wards on the basis of satisfying their population or predicted population growth for a particular scenario. So, some results. I know that's all very long-winded. Some results for London. So, the weather generator work, first of all. Basically, over here is one single run through this 1,000 runs of 30 years worth of data for London up to what we call the 2050s. But because you've got a 30-year run, that's a 15-year envelope either side of 2050. And basically, what we're finding with the weather generator results is that the intra-urban temperature of London potentially could be increasing by up to about nearly 7 degrees across many areas of London into the future for this 90th percentile sampling of the UKCP projection. So it's the most extreme result that we've been able to produce, or that's been produced from the UK climate change projections. Nonetheless, if it actually does take place, we're going to see a significant increase in temperature across a lot of the London, Greater London area. We've also been able to take the weather generated data and not only calculate future average summer temperatures, but also calculate the number of expected heat waves that we may see in London for the same time period at the same percentile. So now the red show us that we potentially into the future on an annual basis may be expecting between 3 and 5 summer heat waves which exceed this 32, 18, 32 temperature for London. To give you an idea, the decade between 2000 and 2009, we had 3 in that whole time period for London. Okay? And that's actually much higher than any other preceding decade that we've had. Okay? We had a heat wave in 2003, 2006, and 2009.
Sorry,
what
exactly the 90th percentile means?
The 90th percentile means from the Met Office climate change projections, if you imagine it as a distribution, there's a probability about how much temperature rise you're going to see. Okay? And what we've done is we've gone right to the tail at the top end of the probability, the 90th percentile, and taken that temperature. Okay, so it's basically saying that this, you know, is there's only a 10% chance that we'll see this temperature rise. But if we do see this temperature rise, these are the temperatures we may expect to see in London and the number of heatwave events.
Is that in the high emission scenario, or is that crossing scenario?
That is the high emission scenario as well. So it really is the extreme that we may expect to see. But we have the results from the medium and also the low scenarios as well across those probability density functions. The take-home message, I guess, from this result is that it's the fact that we're seeing this over an order of magnitude increase in heatwave events in the future, potentially, if we get these sorts of extreme temperature rises taking place in London, okay, compared to the current day. just to sort of show this in a tabular form, I guess, and to give you an idea that not it was all doom and gloom, and it's not all as extreme as that map or those maps suggest. It's in fact only when we do reach the 90th percentile that we actually see this dramatic increase in the number of heatwave events taking place on an annual basis within London. And even at the 50th percentile, at the high emissions scenario, we're still only seeing about 0.3 heatwaves per annum, or one every 3 years within London, this 32-18-32 exceedance. So it's potentially bad news for London, but only if we get the most extreme changes actually taking place in terms of the climate change. This is basically the message that comes out. In terms of temperature, the current day or the control period that we're comparing these results with, the average T-max, summer T-max temperature is 20.87, and again, if we go to the extreme, we are seeing this almost 6 degrees of warming that's taking place. So the IPCC is downscaling of the most recent downscaling of temperature increases, and probably is being a bit optimistic if you believe these results. However, in terms of risk, when we start to include the population projections and the resulting exposure, what we actually find is you get quite a different spatial pattern across London depending on where people are living. So the risk analysis that we've done is relative to the control period, and essentially what we're saying is how much is risk increasing from our control period runs. And what we find is, and this is for, there's a whole host of combinations in here, but the primary thing is this is for the centralised population model that we've been running, we find that you get this increase in risk in and around the immediate centre of London. And although we're going to see lots of temperature increases in other areas of London, according to the weather generator, when we start to look at the population vulnerability and the population projections for this particular scenario, we see it's these areas in or around the centre that are going to be most at risk in the future. So it's not just, as I said, the temperature increases, it's how that spatially intersects with population and the relative exposure of that population. And conscious that I'm running over time here, so I'm going to move very quickly through this. We've not only just looked at risk from the population perspective, but we've also started to look at how sensitive infrastructure is in London and cities to future temperature rises. And in particular, the fact that the rail operators and London Underground, as soon as temperature starts to exceed 28 degrees, actually has to start reducing the speed of the trains on the track. Essentially, that for safety reasons, as you increase the temperature, you basically have to reduce the speed that the trains can travel at. And so we've been using the weather generator output to work out the number of days over a particular year, on average, that in the future we're going to see temperature rises or temperatures above a certain particular threshold. So in this case, the 28 degrees is used by the rail operators. And then started to try and understand what that means in terms of delays and capacity limitations on the rail network for London. So this is one piece of work that my colleague Alistair Ford has done at Newcastle on the Arteria project with myself, where we've taken these spatial temperature maps and then looked at how the cost increase or the top cost will increase in terms of time to travel between different wards in London. And what you start to find is that if you're travelling out from the centre, I can't remember which particular ward in London it is, but it's one in the centre of the City of London, that to travel by train, when you hit this area, which is on a particular day, getting this particular area of heat within the weather generator output, you start to see dramatic increases in time, or cost in time, of taking rail travel across London. Okay, so we're beginning to start to understand the effect that future temperatures will have on infrastructure systems as well as the population. I'll skip over this one if that's okay. To finish off, a lot of this work we've been doing, we've been trying to do it so that the tools that we've developed are generic. You can apply it potentially to any city in the United Kingdom. If you can get the data, I'm not saying that's trivial in some cases, then the methodology that we've been working developing, we think you can apply to more or less just about any major urban conurbation in the whole of the United Kingdom. So in the Scorcho project, we did a very similar piece of work for Greater Manchester and actually developed a user interface tool as a result of the project, actually coded it in ArcGIS. In hindsight, that was actually a bit of a mistake because subsequently we've now moved all of our software into an open source framework. So some poor soul has got to go and recode all this model completely in Python and using PyQt to write the new interface, but that's going to be some poor RA's problem, not mine, that's for sure. But we do have this tool that you can actually play around with all these different scenarios, different weightings, different parameters, and actually look at how adaptable certain different urban configurations are to heat hazard. This is probably the single overhead that's got me into the most trouble ever in my career so far, where for Greater Manchester, we had a stakeholder meeting at the end of the project, so at the end of Scorcho. We got all the respective stakeholder project partners to come in, actually use the software tool, and with a tutorial. Little did I know that somebody pretty high up in planning in Salford City Council was actually doing this tutorial at the point of time, until he almost physically chased me down the corridor to say, why is it just that Salford is the single hotspot of risk, or the greatest hotspot of risk, in the whole of Greater Manchester? So you have to be very careful about how you convey these messages to people. He was not a happy guy at all. All I explained to him was that basically we are doing scenario analysis. A different scenario may give you very different results. You know, and that's the key about all of this. It's an exploratory tool. It's not saying this is absolutely how cities are going to be affected by future heat and temperature increases. It just allows us to look at some possible implications and outcomes. Just going to say, we've done this actually at a regional scale now. This was the T-Valleys area, so this includes Middlesbrough, Hartlepool, all around there. They asked us to go and do this as a piece of consultancy work for their climate change and adaptation plan that they have to bring together. And we're now moving on somewhat in this work, and not just dealing with a single hazard or risk, but thinking about how do we actually start working with multi-objective problems of climate change. So where you've got flooding, you've got heat, you've maybe got planning decisions that are driving you towards having a compact city development, so on and so forth. And Dan Kapiris-Midwood, who's a PhD student of mine, and Richard Dawson's in the Centre for Earth Systems Engineering, is looking at developing these optimization approaches that start to give you this range of different and optimise spatial configurations on the basis of multiple risks or objectives that you want to solve in terms of sustainable cities. So minimising the heat risk, minimising the risk of flooding, but while retaining a compact city development, for example. The approach that he's become very keen on, and I have to say this is, I'm totally in agreement with him here, is that he's using the genetic algorithm to develop all these potential optimised solutions, and then he goes in and he does what we call a parental optimal solution of the optimization to recognise the actual absolute best subset of solutions that actually satisfy the multi-objective criterion that we're working with. So you have this huge space of possible solutions, but using parental optimization, you can actually recognize through this decision boundary the
the set that acts your best in terms of the objectives at hand. And so again, for planners, decision makers, we can actually do things like, let's look at the current planning development plan for the Tees Valley area. This is the solution that we would get for that in terms of minimising distance to development, having a compact city development, and the heat risk, and in fact certain different configurations of future land use will give us a better optimal solution. I'll leave it with one challenge. This is all for our beautiful, lovely, highly developed UK. And the similar work being done in other areas of Europe, so Potsdam University are very big in this area about climate change adaptation. But the real challenge, and the one that everybody's ignoring at the moment, is how on earth do you do this in developing nations, where essentially a lot of the climate models are saying we're going to see the greatest increase in temperature globally, we're going to see the largest increases in population, and the largest increases in urban population occurring in those particular countries, so particularly in Africa, but also large areas of Asia as well. And how on earth do we start to handle their dynamics? Now, I know this is an absolutely terrible, terrible set of images, but it conveys something I think is quite interesting, and it was given to me by a colleague from Fudan University that we're starting to work with. And it shows over a 20-year period, just over 20 years, the urban growth has taken place to the sort of south of Shanghai. So this is about back in about 1990. This is about round about late 1990s. And this is about 2008, 2009. And each of these blooms of purple that you can see is more or less a city in excess of 2 million inhabitants, literally just appearing over those 10-year time intervals. And how on earth do we start to deal with that type of temporal urban dynamics with the types of population growth we're going to see and the types of climate change that we're expecting to see over in developing nations, where we don't have the data to do all the sorts of lovely work that I've hoped to be presented to you today. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, we have a few questions, but maybe 5 to 10 minutes for a few, if there's any.
So, I'm just going to go back to one of the things you said right at the very start, which was that there's been a shift in the discussion in the last 10 years away, almost entirely away from mitigation to adaptation now. And like, you know, you were showing how we can do this, but I remember hearing the Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre, Kevin Anderson, for example, saying that most people don't think a 4 degrees C world is adaptable to. So, the World Bank and the Potsdam report that you were mentioning as well, they say there is absolutely no guarantee that a 4 degrees C world is adaptable to. So what are we kidding ourselves? Are we saying, well, maybe the UK might make it if the rest of the world were not in the equation? Or
in a way, you're taking me well outside my remit to comment on that. We are simply trying to provide the evidence that allows people to make those sorts of decisions. Hopefully, objectively, hopefully in a consistent and rigorous scientific way. Okay. I can offer a personal opinion, which is one that we are going to be left to do the best of a bad job, essentially, I think, personally. And also, we are morally wrong in ignoring developing nations in the way that we have. We have a, you know, to be fair, EBSERC are driven by delivering for UK PLC. There is no real major funding that's going into climate change adaptation in developing nations within the UK, and I firmly believe there should be. I wrote a grant proposal for a fellowship through Leverhulme last year. I felt it was the most innovative and exciting piece of work I'd suggest you could do. It was trying to take some of these techniques and do a proof of concept piece of work with colleagues in Fudan and also somewhere else. And it just got blown away. People were saying it was impossible, we can't do it. Well, you know, we don't start tackling these challenges, we're never going to do it. Yeah, granted, there was lots of, well, maybe this would work, but you know, he's just trying to be honest. We don't know how to tackle these types of issues. And we are, you know, after 10 years, we're just beginning to scrape the surface. We're just actually now, we've just got the tools in place to start doing this IT analysis. So I think it's, personally, I think we're in a difficult situation, but we have to provide the best evidence we can that allows people to do the best that they can in terms of making decisions about adaption. I know that's a bit fluffy.
I think Ian.
A couple of questions and a thought. I don't have any sort of background in the temperature side of things, but coming at work could be quite a bit southeast services. It really struck me where you had your combined scenarios, such as your flooding and the heat and the configurations of the different land covers to see what's the optimal solution there. Now, have you looked at doing that sort of thing in wider ecosystem services, such as carbon, soils, or
we haven't ourselves. I mean, I'll be completely honest, my focus is just I can see how you can start to roll this out.
Yeah.
And I think the type of work Dan is doing in particular, where you've got this use of optimization to look at multi-objective problems,
yes,
is actually the key to doing that properly.
Create scenario maps easily enough, and that's very well. So actually, that idea of finding what the optimal route through that,
yeah,
hitting all those things, is really quite compelling. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're trying to get Dan to do, when we actually sort of, you know, let him loose, is, you know, ultimately at the end of his PhD, we hope to have some kind of tool that people can actually sit down and drag and drop and you know, slide the line along the prep to optimal curve and understand what the relative trade-offs are in terms of the dimensionality.
I'd be really interested to know some more about that. And the second thought was talking about work for developing countries. Have you come across some research being done in Corpus University?
No.
A friend of mine, he's doing stuff on heat modelling in Ho Chi Minh City in Vietnam.
Right.
So I've been doing a study of what I remember is that looking at understand the heat patterns in this kind of this area. There might just be some interesting connections.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carl, I'll pass that on.
I'd be very interested.
Yeah.
Well, Bob.
Thinking about, you know, kind of haphazard way, can I raise one or two points?
Yeah.
I'm wondering about how much difference it makes if you've got a city with more green space, other green space, or more, or the spatial configuration of green space. I will explain why that comes to that moment. But also, wind is partly stimulated by a city I know quite well, Warsaw in Poland. And Warsaw, not very well known in the last one, but very forward looking in the interwar period, the Poland doing in urban planning. And they developed a structure plan for the city back in the 1930s, where the city was to grow outwards, or could grow, and would grow along major transport axes. But between the axes, they would preserve green ribbons, green wedges, green fingers, and that's possibly a better arrangement than a green belt, because it's dynamic. It allows the city to grow, and the green wedges grow with it. And the idea of the green wedges was funded, I think, the green wedges was that. So that's what we find that heat island, or other heat island, convection in the centre, will draw in fresh air from the countryside along these green wedges, also along the river banks, So, I'm kind of this. I don't fully understand what you're doing, but I wonder if a city like Warsaw, with that, which was, it predates the communist period, and it was continued in the communist period, it was probably enforced more strictly there as a structure plan. If an interesting, if you can take account of the effect of wind and current and convection, does, you know, does Warsaw really, does it really come out much better in that context? And does your model take account of wind that might be partly related to convection from the Abinit Island?
Okay, so there's a number of things in there.
Yeah.
So there's been some work, albeit very empirically driven, about the concept of urban greening and urban blue. This idea that if you start to introduce urban green spaces, that may have a mitigation effect with respect to temperatures in cities. The work I've seen on that is, on the whole, inconclusive. And the amount of green space we will need to introduce is pretty phenomenal in order for it to make much of a difference. The work actually that Mark McCarthy did, where he's got he's introduced the RCA and the urban proportions, he was actually quite surprised what little change that made to the resulting temperatures in the regional climate models. And so by implication that suggests that the reverse of that, by introducing lots of green space, isn't going to make that much difference in terms of the RCM. In terms of adapting to the heat, then there is good evidence that local neighbourhoods, urban greening, can make a big influence. Again, it depends on the way you configure it, the way you've just been describing it. And in our work, we don't have things like urban canyons being taken into account. There's been a lot of very good work done in Reading University as part of meteorology there, and they're probably the best group in the UK on the whole micro-urban meteorology and climate field. And there's been talk actually of trying to get these two scales of analysis to actually try and bring them together. There's a project called Lucid, which Reading were very heavily involved in, which is part of the ASCC program, that looked at very much these sorts of problems. If you have a certain configuration of your urban canyon, if it's particular orientation relative to the wind direction, would that make much of a difference in terms of cooling? Off the top of my head, I can't remember the exact value, but there's evidence to say, yes, it does. But what that means in terms of the overall city is not understood, so you can't scale it up. Their modelling is literally done at a single canyon level.
I think I can't tell you this. We could bet you not watch them.
Oh, yeah, they've got essentially a full physically based meteorological model for an urban canyon. So I think there's lots of interesting questions in there. And if you look at the weather station analysis that's been done on cities over 20, 30 decades, going back to the work by Oak, who's probably the original guy in 1980, started looking at urban temperature properly, there's lots of evidence of different spatial configurations in different temperature patterns in cities.
Okay, I think we probably have to. Is it a very quick one, Demetrius?
Yeah, just quick. Thank you. So I'm also interested in the whole developing country creating capacity of actually creating all that data that you use to do this, but from a remote sensing aspect. So are there any satellites or sensors that you see in the future that could be used to create all those great data you have there and put in the model? So we can create the capacity of that data in developing countries that could use that
Well, that's essentially, this Leap of Hume application was basically suggesting that you, to maybe start this type of work, you'd be looking at trying to find suitable remote sense data sets that could act as a surrogate, a proxy for some of the data that we've been using in modelling for the UK. So
using things like the image facing, image shuttle radar to try and get surface texture and surface roughness, which might give us some proxy to the density of residential developments, for example, using HRR to get surface temperature, so we can try and use that rather than actually having to use the model predictions. So it's I think there is a potential area there to look at. It's just trying to convince someone that that's worth funding in a quite an exploratory way, rather than in a way that says actually we know this is going to work, because we just can't have it. You just can't claim that because we don't.
I think in the interest of your trade, before we thank Stuart, thank you for that. Thanks to my helpers for helping set up. The next talk is in a fortnight, so back for more, and we'll be talking on things relating to public participation, see how we can perhaps contribute to some of these things, looking at our cities, temperature and climate. So hopefully see you then. Come along for geo drinks just now, but I think that remains for me to say thank you very much for a very interesting talk. Lots of stuff there.